You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, May 31st, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Bonsoir.
Bonsoir, Evan.
Bonsoir.
I actually knew that one.
You may actually ask why I've chosen French this today to say good evening.
We won't.
Well, no, since you asked, Rebecca. Because it was on this date, June 4th, in 1783, that the Montgolfier brothers publicly demonstrated their Montgolfier hot air balloon. Now, this was not the flight in which one of the brothers, which was Joseph, took the flight and was the first one to ascend in a hot air balloon. This was the unmanned one in which they, were basically proving their theory about lighter than air travel.
Yeah.
Without anyone on board. It lasted about 10 minutes and the balloon almost went about 2 kilometers. And it landed successfully. So it was a successful demonstration.
So is there some law that you had to be two brothers in order to invent flying machines?
That is law.
That's a good point.
Can you imagine watching that for the first time? Lighter than air flight. That must have been epic.
They went from concept to actual balloon in less than a year. They really did their first designs just in 1782, with a couple of basic experiments using much smaller scaled balloons. And when they realized it worked, just a few months later, they had the full thing up in the air.
Yeah. I guess it was just a matter of figuring out how big it had to be, right? In order to lift the amount of weight that they wanted to lift.
That's right.
Isn't it kind of cool, guys, that just hot air alone can lift something heavy like that with people in it? It's very cool.
That's just physics.
Just physics.
It's also cool.
Simple physics.
I've seen cooler.
Yeah, like the guy in the lawn chair with like 1,000 balloons, regular party balloons.
Didn't
yeah,
he like
cool
air
until
vanish?
He almost died. No, I think he survived, didn't he? Like he was up for a Darwin Award, but he didn't quite make it.
By the way, do you guys know what an octothorpe is?
Eight something.
Wait, that sounds familiar. It's the pound sign.
Good job. Yeah, I learned that word for the first time today.
Cool. Good job,
that's
Rebecca.
Correct.
Really? Thank you. That's what a BS in communication will get you.
An octothorpe. Or the pound sign in the U.S., the number sign or the hash key or hash sign in other English-speaking countries. Yeah, it's that little, two vertical.
Tic-tac-toe.
Yeah, little tic-tac-toe thing.
Tic-tac-toe image.
The number sign.
That was random.
Octothorpe was coined by some computer programmers at Bell Labs, but they never quite got it to take off. They were trying to invent a word and then get it to become in widespread use. So always a tough thing to try to manufacture.
Kind of like Alexander Graham Bell. He always wanted people to answer the phone, ahoy, hoy. And now the only person who does it is
Monty Burns.
Monty Burns,
exactly. Yeah.
He's the only one that answers it that way now?
Yes.
As far as I know.
That's right.
And me, occasionally, because I think it's funny.
It is, and it is funny.
Yeah.
So, predicting earthquakes is back in the news.
For all the wrong reasons.
For all the wrong reasons.
Is there ever a right reason?
Well, since you can't predict earthquakes,
that's
probably
point.
Not. No. Until scientists figure out how to actually predict when earthquakes are going to happen.
And they're chaotic, actually. I think they're inherently unpredictable.
That's possible.
Just like the weather. I did read that. I wasn't really quite aware of that, but I read that recently that they are. It's chaotic.
Well, Bob, you need to convince some judges and courts in Italy of that because they seem to be totally lost in the dark when it comes to that. Because there are Italian scientists that are going to stand trial for manslaughter because they didn't successfully predict an earthquake that killed 308 people back in 2009.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Really?
Enzo Boschi, the president of Italy's National Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology, is going to face trial on charges of manslaughter with 6 other scientists and technicians for failing to alert the residents of one of the Italian town where this earthquake happened back on April 6, 2009. Now, they were the 7 of them were sat on the nation's, it's called the Major Risks Committee. And they were probed by prosecutors after members of the public complained that it was the committee's reassurances just 6 days prior to the earthquake that persuaded people not to take any kind of action or leave their homes ahead of the quake, which did wind up happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that someone would maybe sue the people who claim to actually predict quakes because they always get it wrong and they never save any lives. But no, it's the scientists who admit that they are unable to predict quakes right. who get prosecuted.
I mean, isn't this the ultimate straw man, though?
To represent that, the judge, I think you handed this down, Judge Giuseppe Romano Gargarella, said that the defendants had supplied imprecise, incomplete, and contradictory information, which I said...
Welcome to science.
Yeah, that's because the science of earthquakes is imprecise, incomplete, and often produces contradictory information, you know?
Yeah.
That's the nature of the science.
And these scientists never claimed they could predict earthquakes to begin with.
Yeah. They were wrong for the right reason, right? They said there was a series of tremors, and they correctly said... These things happen all the time. It does not necessarily mean there's an earthquake coming. Although one of them was saying, but you know what? We are going to get a big earthquake sometime. It's, mm-hmm. it's coming. We just can't say when. And you know, people shouldn't panic, you know, and whatever, because of these tremors. But then the earthquake just happened to hit a little bit later, 6 days later. So that's just the nature of the game.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Wow. You would think that someone that went through law school and was educated would understand even remotely how science works, or at the very least how in this particular case
you'd think, Jay.
I know. I mean, of course I know the answer before I even say it, but I'm just saying it seems counterintuitive that the judge wouldn't get it, you know, especially after hearing a reasonable explanation.
That's what we see over and over again, though, is that it doesn't take a dumb person to believe in a dumb theory. Anybody can be fooled, even a judge.
So the U.S. Geological Survey chimed in because, you know, these organizations internationally, you know, work together and they support each other and they communicate often. And they said, according to their website, neither the USGS nor Caltech nor any other scientists have ever predicted a major earthquake. They do not know how, and they do not expect to know how any time in the foreseeable future. They say we're not able to predict earthquakes very well at all.
There's a couple other wrinkles to this story, though. Some are saying that the seismologists are being accused not simply because they could not predict the quake, but because they were, you know, reassuring the public that no quake was imminent, and therefore they frustrated attempts at taking precautionary action. So while, you know, the public was saying, you know, what should we do? Should we leave the cities? And they said, no, calm down, relax, drink some wine. There's no reason to panic. So it's not so much their inability to make a prediction as their reassurances that there wasn't an imminent quake. The other thing is that a technician working in their lab was saying that there was a quake that was going to happen. He was using a method of measuring radon gas in order to predict when a quake is imminent. Now, this is not a proven method. It's not an accurate predictor. And that's why the other scientists disagreed with him. So he was coming out and saying a quake is imminent, and the scientists were correcting that, saying this is not good science. We can't rely upon this. And then just as luck would have it, the quake, in fact, did hit. It wasn't exactly when and where he said, but it was close enough for people to then think, hey, that guy was right and the other scientists were wrong. In fact, he only got lucky. He was right, again, for the wrong reasons. His radon gas method, you know, has never been demonstrated to be an accurate predictor. So that's another aspect here that is not necessarily getting enough attention in the English-speaking press. It might also be that the government's basically trying to cover their ass by blaming the scientists.
That's what it sounds like to me.
You know, we didn't do the things that we should have done, but that's because we were reassured by those damn scientists who made the wrong prediction. But it's more that, you know, their job is to figure out you know, how best to apply the precautionary principle, right? How best to take the uncertainty in the science, how does that translate into what do? We don't want people in a constant state of panic because we can't predict when the earthquakes are going to happen. But at the same time, you cross a threshold where it's reasonable to take certain precautions.
But aren't we overreacting by putting these people up for manslaughter?
Oh, absolutely. It's ridiculous. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Think of the precedent.
Right. That's exactly right, Bob. You know, and there are other people talking about this precedent that might be set. And people are concerned. Scientists are concerned about it. Alan Leshner, who's the chief executive of AAAS, which is a scientific group, said his group wrote a letter to the Italian government last year, which apparently had no effect. And Leshner said, whoever made these accusations misunderstands the nature of science, the nature of the discipline, and how difficult it is to predict anything with the surety that they expect. And this will have a chilling effect on scientists everywhere. It reflects a lack of understanding about what science can and can't do, and frankly, it will have an effect of intimidating scientists. Just, it feels like that they're scapegoating or an attempt to intimidate a community, and it's very inappropriate. I agree with those statements.
It certainly seems that way, yeah.
Yeah, it can't lead to anything good, that's for sure.
I don't know, though. I mean, my feeling is that, say they do get prosecuted. I mean, they do pay for this in some way. I just think other countries would think it's so ridiculous that I don't think they'd be intimidated. I just think it would be such a joke.
Well, other scientists
pathetic.
In Italy would be intimidated.
Locally. Local scientists, yeah. But beyond that, I don't think it would spread very far, though. I think outside, people would just laugh. Like, yeah, right. Give me a break.
And practically, this kind of thing can have a brain drain on Italy, right? I mean, scientists may decide to practice elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So that they're not subject to that. So that could be extremely detrimental. I mean, you don't want to alienate your scientists.
Steve, the source of this problem to me seems to be the idea that scientists are not trusted, and that is the actual source of the problem. It isn't that, you know, one judge or a jury just found scientists to be guilty of something. I just think there's a basic distrust, and we need to change the culture of that.
I don't know that I agree with that. I don't know that we know that from this news story. I don't know what that judge is thinking. If it is just a culture of distrust of science, I mean, there is a culture of distrust to some extent, but it's actually not that bad overall. Scientists are still a fairly respected profession overall. I think it crops up more in pockets and with regard to specific issues and groups of people. Well, let's move on. Bob, you're going to tell us about attempts to thoroughly map the human brain.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. I love big incentives for big projects that could potentially at least create game-changing technologies. Now, one that you may hear about soon is called the Human Brain Project, which aims to model a human brain in a supercomputer to such a degree that it could not only offer insights into diseases of the brain, but also help design future supercomputers. The incentive for a project like this comes from the European Union. They formed a formal initiative called FET, which stands for Future Emerging Technologies. And their plan over a period of years is to create these FET flagships, these research initiatives, that these grand ideas that they will fund for at least 10 years with a lot of money, you know, to further their goals. And their website, as it kind of encapsulates it nicely, they say that these FET flagships are ambitious, large-scale, science-driven research initiatives that aim to achieve a visionary goal. The scientific advance should provide a strong and broad basis for future technological innovation and economic exploitation in a variety of areas, as well as novel benefits for society. And I think that's a great description for what they want to achieve, and I think it's a great, great idea. Now, the funding that I mentioned is fairly significant. 1 billion euros, or about, what is it? What is that, $5 quintillion? No, it's a $1.5 billion. But either way, that's some serious incentive for some really cool research. Like I said, they planned 15 of these flagship initiatives. The Human Brain Project is one of about five or so international projects that are all vying to be among the first two that are going to be picked, I believe, in 2013. So right now they're pretty much, a lot of these representatives from these international projects are like touring Europe trying to just to drum up support for the research that they want to engage in and get people interested in the human brain project is one of them. Other researchers are advocating things like graphemes, which is this ultra-thin carbon sheets for use in computer technology. Another group of people want to do robotic assistance systems and also create virtual patients, which can be used for creating and testing individual therapies. That's interesting as well. So now much of the focus for the Human Brain Project has been on Professor Henry Markram, who was the director of the Human Brain Project. Now, if you remember, I believe we talked about him a little bit a while back about the Blue Brain Project. That project was trying to understand the molecular makeup of the mammalian brain. What he did was he simulated what's called a neocortical column at the cell level of a rat, and which is these neocortical columns are the fundamental unit of the cortex. You can think of it that way. They're these neural circuits that are repeated throughout the brain. Markram has a really great analogy. He describes them as the network units of the brain. So they modeled that fairly successfully, and this Human Brain Project is essentially a continuation of that research. He said that our aim is to use supercomputers to establish how the brain is designed and to build a biologically detailed simulation. Now, a major goal he wants to achieve, which I think is really laudable, is to bring together research, all the research, as much as he can. There's about 200,000 neuroscientists in the world who've created millions of scientific articles. Markram says that this knowledge is fragmented. It's time to bring these pieces together. And that of course, is a great goal, not for many sciences, not just brain research. Now, the benefits, he stresses the benefits like the diagnoses and treatments of disease, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, autism, and depression. He says 1 in 3 of us will get some form of brain disease in our lives, so we need to solve that. Obviously, that would be great if we could really seriously address these things. I already mentioned supercomputer design, which he has talked about, using this creation of his to create even more sophisticated supercomputers. Now, I don't know why he seems to be downplaying the really exotic potential of such an artificial brain. And I think he might be doing that because the potential downfall of research like that. I mean, look at the Human Genome Project. As fantastically successful as it was, still people are disappointed because, hey, you know, we mapped out the human genome, what was it, over 10 years ago. And, you know, still patients aren't really getting tangible benefits. And that's kind of true. There's no dramatic breakthroughs that people kind of anticipated when the Human Genome Project was really in the news over a decade ago. But still, the research has been significant. And I still think there's tremendous advances just waiting for us once we really learn more about this. And just mapping the genome, we realize, well, there's more to it. There's more, that's really the first step, the first big important step. And there's many other steps required to really reap a lot of these benefits. You can make the argument that it was overhyped. And I think he might be trying to avoid that if he starts talking about AIs and singularities and crazy stuff. But I think he's trying to avoid that hyperbole.
Now, Bob, if they make a virtual map of the human brain in a supercomputer, do you think that virtual brain simulation would actually be an artificially intelligent, self-aware being?
I mean, I can't answer that based on what you said. I mean, it depends on how the components interact and lots, so many variables. I can't say until I had more information.
This is the interesting question. This is a question I find interesting. Let's say it's a standard supercomputer.
Standard?
Yeah, meaning no new technologies that we don't have today. It's what we would consider a supercomputer today, but it's big and fast enough that it could do this. It could pull it off.
All right, so from a hardware perspective, you're talking.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but it's right. Silicon, integrated circuits. It's what we have today.
Right.
Nothing new. And the model of the brain is virtual, right? It's a virtual model of the brain. But that virtual brain can process information in the computer. Can that result in an actual self-aware, artificially intelligent being?
I think it can. Sure. I don't think there's anything special, and I don't think you think either, that there's anything special about, electrochemical, squishy, biological brains that you need that. I think you can, in principle, potentially have some sort of self-awareness in a substrate like silicon, sure. But what it would take, how sophisticated would it have to be, speed isn't, it's got to be fast, otherwise it'll be thinking pretty slowly. But the software, I think, man, that's the key, and how the individual components interact, and what kind of resolution you know, would you really need? I mean, I don't think you would need, you know, quantum resolution, because I don't think quantum effects really apply to consciousness. But
so I agree with all the things that you said, but it's not really answering my question. So
well,
yes,
I would say no, Steve. I would say no, and I'll tell you why. There are things that the wetware of our brain does that no hardware today can simulate, or at least nowhere near as fast. Right? So our brain actually is communicating with different parts of itself constantly in ways that we don't even understand yet. You know, I don't think that we could – the hardware is there today to do it. Do you?
I agree, Jay, but that's – again, you're not really addressing my question. So what the two where you were talking about is if we manage to build an artificial brain out of some hardware that can do all the things a human brain does – then I think we all agree, yeah, that would be an artificial brain. It would be self-aware, artificially intelligent, no problem there. But what I'm saying is you build a virtual brain, so it's software. It's
right.
The hardware is standard, you know, off-the-shelf hardware. It's nothing. The hardware doesn't do anything special, doesn't do what the brain does. It's just lots of processing power. Let's say it's got the capacity, it's fast enough to, you know, whatever. But there's a virtual representation of a brain inside the software of that computer. Can it be truly self-aware? If it's capturing all that functionality but only in its virtual representation, does that still enable it to be self-aware, or do you need to do that in hardware?
I would say, yeah, I think it could still in principle be self-aware, and the fact that it's virtual doesn't detract from that.
Which means that just, you know, regular silicon computer chips can be self-aware then, if you actually put the right software in it.
Right. Yep. I would agree with that.
See, that's the thing. I have a hard problem with that.
Why? I'm not a substrate chauvinist.
Okay, it's not just about the substrate. It's how the substrate's organized. And again, I don't know the answer. When I say I have a problem with it, I don't mean I don't believe that that's the case. I'm not sure how to figure out what the answer is. I think that if you do simulate the brain virtually, whatever you simulate will have the functionality. But will it really be self-aware, or just be simulating self-awareness?
How do you tell the difference?
That's the biggest problem. But you know, I kind of agree with Jay. I also can see from the point of view that unless you have physical substrate that can do something like what our brains do, that it won't be genuinely self-aware. So I can kind of make an argument either way about the virtual brain.
I know. I mean, can you argue that humans aren't just doing a very good simulation of self-awareness?
Well, that's a good point, and I agree with that.
Some of us are.
Right. I mean, with Jenny McCarthy, for instance. Yeah, but...
Yeah, that's the Daniel Dennett approach, that self-awareness is all an illusion anyway.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm of the opinion that there's no such thing as free will and all of that. So to me, self-awareness seems like it's another or related to the great illusion that is free will. Like our brains are just really good at tricking us into thinking that we are one, you know, unique individual as opposed to just a collection of bits that all work together very well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that point, though, when it gets sufficiently complicated, what's the difference?
Well, the difference when you're talking about something like free will is the idea of, is there a self that is pulling on the controls, you know, that is making the decisions, or are we just an endless, and I say just in scare quotes, I suppose, an endless series of cause and effect? I'm convinced by people who argue for the latter, but I'm no philosopher.
you just play one in this podcast.
Yeah.
It's interesting. But I would love to switch such a thing on and see how it behaves. That would be awesome.
Mm.
Let me ask you another question, Bob. Mm-hmm. What do you think about just the very concept of this project? We're going to give $1.5 billion to this really long-term research vision, like mapping the entire human brain. It sounds like you like that approach.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Because a lot of times, a lot of good ideas just can't get the funding. There's so much competition out there for some of this real exotic stuff. And 10 years, that's a long time. Not many companies want to invest the time and the money into these you know, these long-term projects because their horizons are so close. They're concerned about the next quarter, the next half, and they're not thinking long-term, and that's a great that's to our detriment. And the United States is a classic example of that. There's lots of other countries that are more long-term thinking. I think that it's going to really bite us in the ass.
I don't disagree with that at all, Bob, but I think one thing that seems to be missing from this conversation is how important it is for us to be very careful about these types of technologies and over-prepare for the results, you know.
Yeah, my question was, what do you think about funding research in this manner? And it sounds like you're in favor of it, and you gave some compelling reasons. You know, you want to be able to fund long-term projects where the researchers don't have to worry about, you know, meeting some short-term goals. You know, they just want to be able to have the security to pursue a long-term research goal. And I agree with that. But I do have mixed feelings about the approach because I think the risk is that you will back some approach that may not turn out to be the right answer long-term. So you lose some of the dynamism,
flexibility,
creative destruction. You know, you have to be
the hydrogen economy.
Exactly. This is like 10 years ago, and this is what happened. I mean, like GM picked hydrogen, and look where they are now, right? They totally screwed themselves. You backed the wrong pony early on. I think that for long-term funding projects, it's better to pick a goal and not a technology or not a specific, you know, very specific thing. So, like, if your goal is clean energy, fund clean energy research. Don't pick a winner. Don't say, well, I'm going to fund solar. I'm going to pick solar and fund that because that may end up being the wrong choice. That's my concern is that they should be more goal-oriented and not so – and not focus too much on how to achieve a specific goal or what you know research paradigm is going to pan out.
I agree, but if I could address that one thing, Steve, real quick. If you remember now what I said when I quoted from the website for a reason, because look at this one line. I'll say it again. The advance should provide a strong and broad basis for future technological innovation and economic exploitation. That's a great goal that for this, and I think that kind of addresses what you're seeing. If they keep that in mind as they pick these projects, it probably would be very helpful. But so that you're right, that is important. I agree, that is important. Don't pick a horse that necessarily is going to drop dead halfway through the race.
Well, let's move on. Actually, one more news item. This one is about implanting false memories, an important part of the whole skeptical outlook is to have a healthy distrust for the way our brains function. We've been talking about that already tonight. But one of the things specifically is how malleable our memories are, far more malleable than we would like to think, and far more malleable than we tend to think and behave on a day-to-day basis. You know, we tend to function as if our memories are, you know, accurate recorders of the past. But there are different kinds of memory, and we have to be clear. I mean, in terms of like memorizing facts, our brains are actually pretty good, and some people in particular can memorize vast amounts of data. But in terms of our autobiographical memories of things that happened to us in the past, terrible. We tend to weave a story. That then gets constantly updated and changed with our current view of the world and what's happened. We actually contaminate it with other things that have been suggested to us. We, again, update it to take into account information we didn't know at the time that we formed the memory in the first place. Every time we remember a memory, we're actually reworking it in the very process of remembering it. It's a constantly changing, evolving thing like water. It's not anything that's solid or written in stone. This is just one study in the vast literature of memory that shows that, and this was published in the Journal of Consumer Research for a reason. What these researchers did was they created a fake type of Orville Redenbacher popcorn, and then they exposed subjects to ads that were either very vivid or that were not very vivid.
What do you mean by vivid?
So a vivid ad is one that like really describes the experience of eating the popcorn and how it tastes and really mm-hmm. encourages you to imagine, you know, yourself experiencing the popcorn.
Okay.
As opposed to a non-vivid ad, which is just giving dry facts about it.
Mm-hmm.
Then a week following this, they had the subjects in both groups fill out surveys. Also, what they did is they took some of the people and they actually allowed them to taste the popcorn. It was just some other kind of popcorn, but they said it was the fake kind that they were market testing. Then a week later, they asked the subjects questions about products, about a lot of products, again, to sort of disguise the ones that they were interested in. They didn't ask them just about the popcorn. And they also asked them, like, have you ever actually tasted this product before? Like, have you ever actually eaten the popcorn before? The people who were given the vivid ads were just as likely to remember having tried the popcorn as the people who actually ate it. But not the people who had the non-vivid ads. So that was sort of like a good control. It wasn't just the way they were asking the questions or whatever. There was a significant difference between the vivid ads and the non-vivid ads. The researchers interpreted that as the vivid ads actually created a false experience memory, a false memory of having had the experience. So just imagining in vivid detail, you know, something like eating popcorn can create a false memory that you actually did it.
Total recall.
Yeah. It's amazing how easy it is to manufacture a false memory.
Yeah.
The other thing was that this is why this is published in the Journal of Consumer Research, is that the false memory of having had the experience yourself generated much more positive attitude towards the product, because now you think it's you have a personal connection there, you actually tried it. So it's essentially demonstrating that it's very effective marketing, advertising, to produce sort of a vivid experience as part of the advertising. People might start to merge the commercials with their own memories of their own, you know, autobiographical experiences and think, oh yeah, I was whatever in that situation. I was on the beach drinking that drink and it was great, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Unbelievable. That's the scary thing to me, is that
it's scary.
And I know this is already happening. The degree to which the marketing culture has keyed into the psychological research and realizes how easy it is to manipulate people. And in profound ways,
yeah.
To really exploit all the foibles of our neurology, you know.
In a way, Steve, this research seems to be even dangerous because it confirms something and could even empower people to use it.
Yeah.
Well, it's nothing that the ad industry hasn't already known enough about to use anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, they exploit our psychology all over the place.
Yeah. Exactly. And they often do these kind of studies, or at least, you know, test, you know, market research in order to confirm these theories. So yeah, there's no hiding from marketing, unfortunately. They're always going to have a leg up on you when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah, I think you just need a certain baseline suspiciousness of all marketing.
As I mentioned earlier, that's what my degree is in, and yeah. I always felt...
Really?
Yeah, it's
mine too.
Really?
how useless was that?
You have a degree?
But yeah, you know, taking all these advertising courses, I always thought how helpful it would be to pretty much everyone. I feel like everybody should have this, and not at the college level. I feel like it should be part of grade school curriculum. You know, here is what these cereal ads are trying to say to you. You know, here's how to understand when something is, you know, a product placement as opposed to a genuine endorsement from someone without a bias, things like that. People don't know it. Some people don't have those tools. We talk about occasionally a bullshit detector. People need, you know, or a baloney detection kit. And I think that that's a really good one to have, is the ability to detect when you're being sold to. When marketers are trying to get one over on you.
Yeah, when you're being manipulated.
Mm-hmm. That is a great idea.
trying to affect your behavior. I mean,
yeah,
always got to be thinking, all right, what are the, you know, what's their ultimate goal here?
That's, and they're not just trying, they do it.
Oh, yeah.
And now they're implanting false memories. Thank you.
And Rebecca, I would argue that the further back you go in a child's education, the younger they are, the more it will serve them. The more you teach a young child to ask questions and to question reality, the farther it'll go.
Oh, definitely. And we've talked before about the importance of teaching young kids critical thinking and encouraging that, you know, and how young kids are sort of natural critical thinkers. So it's easy for them. Yeah. They like doing it, you know. And
it's empowering, and they like feeling empowered.
And I don't think it's, you know, for a kid, I think it's, that is one of the most important areas where you can teach critical thinking, because they, you know, if they are living in a Western country, at least, you know, in a developed nation, they're going to be marketed to nonstop from the time they are old enough to glance at the TV, at a magazine, at a billboard. Advertisers are trying to reach them, and
yeah,
it's really worthwhile to teach them how to deal with those things early on.
Absolutely. You know, we often get asked, you know, how to teach kids critical thinking. And that is something I do all the time, is when I am, say, watching TV with my kids and a commercial comes on, I will just, you know, casually ask my daughters questions about the commercial. Like, do you really think that that's true? And what do you think they're saying here? And what, you know, what are they trying to accomplish? And get them to start, you know, the commercials are a great opportunity, in other words, to teach some critical thinking skills. And kids can get the concept. Yeah, they're trying to sell me something.
Yeah.
That's something that they could wrap their head around. And then when they see the man behind the curtain, you know, you start to tell, the, you know, they'll figure it out. You just ask the right questions. They'll figure it out for themselves. Mm-hmm. Then they feel really good. It's like, oh, wow, I'm seeing how things really work here. You know, I'm not just this passive, you know, person who has no control or no sense of what's going on in my environment. I think that kids often feel like they're overwhelmed by adult society. Adult society is just, they just take for granted that they don't understand it because they're kids, and they're often being told, yeah, this is for adults. You don't understand this. You're just a kid. Mm-hmm. So giving them sort of a glimpse into adult society and how things actually operate, they love that.
Yeah.
And that you could, you know, ride that train of critical thinking right through that huge hole. It works really well. Evan, take us to Who's That Noisy?
You got it, Steve. Now, I'm going to play for you last week's Who's That Noisy as a reminder of what you heard and what you all guessed on. So here we go.
To quantum physicists like Amit Goswami saying, you're seeing prana and chi, you're seeing the life force. To consciousness expert Stuart Hameroff saying, oh, synesthetes have a lower threshold to quantum consciousness. This is an entanglement, much like psychic phenomenon.
Did you get all that gobbledygook?
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
Did it make any sense whatsoever?
No. Kind
of, maybe,
couple,
sort of.
A couple words did.
Yeah, a couple words.
It was quantum woo. Pretty standard.
Who was it? Well, who do you think would utilize terms like that?
Deepak Chopra.
Exactly. Well done, Rebecca.
That was Deepak Chopra's.
No, it was not Deepak Chopra.
Wife.
But we'll get to that. But no, you're correct in assuming that someone like Deepak Chopra is the kind of person who throws around terms like that carelessly and has no, basically talking out his ass. That's a woman named Maureen Seberg. She is a New York City-based journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, the Daily Beast, the Daily News, ESPN the magazine. She's been on PBS and MSNBC.
Good
and she won
her.
Some scholarship to some writer's colony, blah, blah, blah. She is a synesthete. How do I pronounce that, Steve?
Synesthete.
She is a synesthete. She's on an organizing committee called the Toward a Science of Consciousness Conference, which is this annual conference that is sponsored by the University of Arizona, of all places.
And so I went
and took a look online at exactly what this conference was all about. Oh, and look who appears there right on the front page along with this woman. Deepak Chopra.
Mm. Oh, boy.
Trinok from the message boards found the clip I used and was the first one to guess correctly. Well done, sir.
Good job.
Very good job.
What do you got for this week?
For for this week, I have something unique, very unique, the most unique.
You can't, don't. Uniquest. Don't do that.
The uniquest?
The most uniquest of all things unique. Are you all ready?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Bated breath and all?
Sure.
Just do it.
I'm not ready, but keep going.
Okay, Rebecca, this one's for you.
Jay. Oh. Thank you.
I'll put that in.
Yeah, right, Steve.
Anyway.
Okay, so there you have it. Give us your best guess, info@theskepticsguide.org, or post it on our forums. Good luck, everyone.
All right, well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Jamie Bernstein. Jamie, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Jamie is the vice president of the Women Thinking Free Foundation, a foundation that supports free thinking among women but abhors adverbs, apparently. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that first?
Well, at Women Thinking Free Foundation, we kind of have two main things we do. One of them is that we put on science events in the Midwest for anybody living in the area. But the other thing that we do is run the Hug Me, I'm Vaccinated campaign.
That sounds like a good campaign.
Thank you.
So clearly you're on the PharmaShill payroll.
Yeah, definitely. As you know, a poor student, apparently. That's how I pay my tuition.
So Jamie, how'd you get started in doing all this?
I went to TAM, actually, 2 years ago. And then about a month later, I moved to Chicago. And I was so excited about all the skeptic stuff after TAM that I wanted to meet skeptics here. And so I went to an event and I met Elise. And the rest is kind of history.
Elise Anders, fellow skeptic.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're supposed to say that we inspired you, but that's okay.
Hey, I'll take a skeptic sort of.
All right.
Steve, you could put that in post-production, don't worry.
That's true. Right. All right, the reason that we are interviewing you tonight, Jamie, in addition just to being awesome and doing the WTFF
thing,
is because you got expelled from a conference. You were kicked out for unruly, disruptive behavior.
Something like that. Or just sitting quietly and listening to lectures.
In an unruly manner.
Yes, apparently.
Tell us about
what exactly happened.
Well, you know, I went to the event originally because I wanted to understand a little bit more of how the anti-vaccine movement does their messaging. I wanted to know what makes them so compelling to parents.
The event being the Autism
The Autism One Conference. It's just outside of Chicago every year. And basically anybody who's anybody within the anti-vaccine movement is there. And so I went with Ken Rybel from Autism Newsbeat, and we spent all morning there. Everything was just fine. We saw Wakefield speak. We saw Jenny McCarthy speak. And later that day, we had left to go get Starbucks, and we came back in. And we had pre-registered for the event.
Yeah.
We paid, and it had all been approved. I mean, everything had been fine up to that point.
So you went to Starbucks, you got all caffeined up.
Exactly.
That's when the rabble rousing started. You were kicking over booths and making trouble for people.
And hyper fidgeting.
Yeah, either that or we just walked back in and somebody recognized Ken.
Uh-huh.
He had gone 2 years before with a press pass and gotten kicked out then, and they do not like his website. So they know who he is, and two women saw us and clearly recognized him. Mm-hmm. So we were a little bit nervous. We'd heard that a Chicago Tribune reporter had gotten kicked out the day before. We were kind of like, well, you know, we're not doing anything wrong, so I'm sure everything will be fine. And people were kind of watching us, but we just ignored them and went about our business. And at some point, I took out a camera because I wanted to take a picture. They were selling these hyperbaric chambers for children.
Whoa.
And I thought it would be interesting to take a picture of it.
What did they cost?
I don't know. I didn't get a chance to find out. So, because at this point, everything kind of got all messed up. So, but I was looking at them. I got out my camera, took a picture. And next thing I know, Terry Arenga, who I'm not exactly sure who she is, but she's one of the people with Autism One. She all of a sudden was by my side, and she told me, she's like, what are you doing? You're not allowed to take a picture. And it was strange because nowhere in any of the material on any sign did it say that you were not allowed to take pictures.
Right.
So I apologize, and I told her I just didn't know that since it wasn't, you know, written anywhere. And I told her I wouldn't do it again. And at this point,
well, clearly it was your attitude that got you kicked out. I mean,
yeah, I was trying to be really nice because I knew there was a chance we could get kicked out, and I really didn't want to be. So I was trying to be as nice as possible. At this point, she told me, she was like, you know, it's on all these signs. You're not allowed to take pictures. And I'm like, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't see them. And she goes, you know, I'll get one for you so you can see it.
Evidence. That's good. They normally can't produce that.
So. Yeah, I was fine with that. I was like, oh, great. Like, you'll get me the sign that says I'm not allowed to take pictures. And so she sent her friend. And her friend came back with this sign that said, no audio or video recordings. Mm-hmm. And so I pointed out that it did not say anything about still photography. And in fact, I'd seen people taking pictures all day. So it was strange that I was kind of, you know, I'm the only one that apparently is not allowed to take pictures. And she told me that it was on a different sign.
Yeah.
And that she would get her friend to get that sign.
So they have Amazing. A bag of signs that, you know, right. cover any circumstance that they don't like.
No people with blue and red hair.
I told her it was fine. Like, I believed her. I wouldn't take any more pictures. I would be good. Like, you know, and I was like, can I go? And she was just really rude about it. She kept asking me if I had a child with autism, which I don't. I don't have any kids.
How dare you?
Yeah, I think she was like trying to catch me or something. Right. I don't know. But it turned out she was just stalling until security could get there.
Hmm.
And so security showed up. No police. It was just hotel security. And she left Ken and I with security. And we still like didn't know what we had done wrong. I asked the security guards and they said they had no idea. They were just told to watch us. Yeah, that was their response.
Because you're so shady. That makes
yeah, perfect. Yeah. And okay. So eventually Terry comes back with a bunch of police officers. And the police officers come up to Ken and I and tell us, you know, are you aware that you've been asked to leave? And up till this point, nobody had asked us to leave. And it kind of felt like maybe Terry had said something to them, like that we'd been asked to leave and refused. It was very strange. But we told them, you know, that nobody had told us, but we'll gladly leave if they would like us to, although we don't know why we're being asked to leave. At this point, we got questioned by the police. I was questioned separately, and the police asked me if I was a journalist.
Is that against the law now?
Yeah, apparently I'm not allowed to be a journalist. And I'm not a journalist, but they kept asking, they were like, are you sure you're not a journalist? You don't work for a magazine, do you? And they're like,
oh,
are you
planning on reading
about this? It was very weird. All of their questions pertained to whether I was like, who I was working for.
Jamie, you should have said, you know, yeah, you're right. It is true. I'm a journalist. I write for the internet.
Yeah, I know, really. Everybody's I mean, I don't even have my own blog. I have nothing. So, and I kept telling, I'm like, no, I'm here by myself. I just wanted to see the conference. I swear, like, I'm not a journalist. Like, why are you doing this to me? And Terry Arenga, she was very strange. At one point, I was texting a friend because they had just left me there for a while. And I was texting my friend about my evening plans. And Terry came and looked over my shoulder to, like, see what I was writing. And she's like, what are you doing? Who are you talking to?
Oh, and my God.
I was like, nothing. Like, I'm trying to make plans with my friend for tonight. Like, why are you asking me this? It was really strange. Like, she was really paranoid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what deep, dark secrets were you learning at this meeting that they didn't want to reach the public?
Nothing that wasn't being live streamed on the internet anyway.
Right.
So we didn't even talk to anybody when we were there. We were not confrontational. We were completely cooperative. Terry seemed to think that we were like part of some sort of weird conspiracy to like shut down their conference and disrupt everything.
Well, we see a lot of conspiracy mongering amongst the anti-vaccine crowd anyway. This idea that Big Pharma and the government are in bed together in order to get our money and kill our children. So I guess it's not out of the question to think that they would see a vast conspiracy because two people from the internet show up, I guess.
It is very strange that she felt so strongly compelled to basically, you know, trap you guys there until the security came to remove you. And it makes me wonder what it has taken place at these events in the past that would possibly lead them to be that fearful. Because, you know, I'll tell you from the less than 100, but way more than a couple of dozen events that I've been to over the past few years, the skeptics don't care who shows up. Like, you know, like there isn't any of that looking over your shoulder type stuff. So it does make me think that they may very well be in fear of people like really getting a behind the scenes look if they're not true believers in their cause. What do you think, guys?
I think it's partly that. I think it's also an absolute intolerance of dissenting opinion. In that way, they are very much like a cult. You know, it's like you have to toe the line. You have to be a believer. If you're not a believer, then you're an infidel. And it's the same thing with the autism, Age of Autism blog. They ban anyone who expresses any skepticism or dissenting views there. It's a completely intellectually closed, dishonest approach. They justify that by saying that they want to create a quote-unquote safe environment, right? They don't want parents to be subjected to what? Opinions? You know, it has to all be safe.
Science?
Yeah, critical thinking, you know. So that's what it is.
And just to see it briefly from their point of view, this is how I imagine they must feel. If we had a board that was helping, like a forum that was helping people with cancer, and we had someone coming on and constantly giving people false hope about alternative cures, I could see a person being banned in that situation because you feel like this is a sensitive population of people suffering from something and this person is spreading misinformation and getting in the way. And I think that that's how they see it. I mean, if I had to take a stab in the dark, I think they see it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that's how they parents, justify to themselves.
Yeah, these parents are, you know, they are the parents of autistic children, and that is a really, it can be a really difficult thing to do, you know, to have autistic children. So, yeah, I think they see themselves as a bit of a put upon minority that needs to be protected.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that probably, with the exception of Wakefield, and of course I could be wrong, I'm just guessing here, but with the exception of Wakefield, I would imagine that most people involved truly believe it and are emotional about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, and David Gorski makes this point a lot. We generally think that the true believers, in this case the anti-vaccinationists, again, there's always con artists thrown in there, right, or exploiters. But generally speaking, your rank and file anti-vaccinationist or true believer of whatever stripe are just normal, sincere, honest people who believe what they are promoting, who are trying to do the right thing. They're just wrong. They're just misinformed. They're caught in an echo chamber, conspiracy theory, and they're systematically misinformed, and they've been shut off from more reliable information. But they think that we are evil, that we're all shills, baby-eating, evil, you know, completely compromised. That's what they think. They don't think that we mean well and are just have a different opinion than they do.
Yeah. Well, and Jamie, speaking of Andrew Wakefield, you've met Andrew Wakefield, right?
Yeah, last year. It was actually, they did the conference and then they did a rally. It was the same weekend as the conference, so like exactly a year ago.
Mm-hmm. And were you kicked out of that too?
No, because they had no idea who I was, and I kind of acted like I was one of them, and it was fine. That rally was much scarier than the conference was.
In what way?
The conference kind of had a positive feel about it. It was very kind of like support group like. Whereas the rally that I went to last year was, I mean, it was full of hate, I guess would be the right way to put it. I mean, they had every single speaker at some point mentioned Nazis or Hitler. Wow. I mean, it was scary, and they really believed this stuff. And so being there and knowing that I wasn't one of them and knowing that they believe that I am just as bad as Hitler, yeah, is really scary. So when I was there, I was even more careful. I mean, I would never go back to a rally like that now that I think that they might recognize me. They were at some points advocating violence against people who, wow, are pro-vaccine. Really? I mean, my heart was beating. Like, it was scary. It was like I was in enemy territory. Whereas, like, the Autism One conference didn't have that feeling at all. In fact, I actually heard very little on vaccines. I didn't get to go. They had some talks later that were going to be specifically on vaccines. They had, like, Olmsted and Blaxall. But I didn't get to go to those because I was kicked out.
Mm. What you've been doing so far has been fantastic, you know, with WTFF and everything. Because I think that this particular brand of pseudoscience is so incredibly dangerous that it gets a lot of us really worked up, you know, really passionate about it. And I think it's great to have a voice out there that is very moderate in its way and respectful, even when maybe they don't deserve your respect. I think it really illustrates exactly how bad they are when someone politely shows up to their conference, sits quietly, and still gets kicked out. Somehow, I think it makes more of an impact than if someone were to have gone and shouted out.
Absolutely. Know. I mean, it's like P.Z. Myers being expelled from the viewing of Expelled, in which he was actually appearing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Similar to that. And you just create bad PR for yourself. I mean, they came off terribly in this whole episode, you know, like paranoid and rude, and it's really just nonsensical.
My favorite part of Jamie's article was when she described how Jenny McCarthy basically talked for a few minutes and then kind of pulled someone else up on stage. So why don't you describe that real quick for us?
Yeah. So before we got kicked out, we actually got to see Jenny McCarthy, and she was like co-keynote speaker with this other woman, but really she only spoke for about 5 to 10 minutes. She actually told a really cute, adorable story. Like she's a very compelling person. Yeah, she only spoke for about 5 to 10 minutes, and then she brought this New Agey lady on named Byron Katie. She has a program called The Work, which kind of seemed similar to The Secret, but not quite. But it was kind of a blame the victim kind of thing. Mm. And under every seat, we had these worksheets. She called them worksheets, where it would say, like, I feel blank at blank because blank. So you would fill, and you know, you would fill that in. So like the first woman said, I feel angry with my husband for not accepting me as a whole person. And then she would bring those people up on stage and turn it around on them and say, you know, are you angry because you do not, or your husband does not accept you? Or do you not accept your husband? And then she would make them repeat it. Like, I do not accept my husband.
Oh my God.
That's a parody of itself.
Yeah,
I've seen that skit on like The Simpsons and Saturday Night Live, this sort of completely simplistic self-help guru type thing. I'm just going to reverse whatever you say and reflect it back at you, and that's my big intervention.
Yeah.
Yeah, and ridiculous. I think one of the last people to go up, her thing was, I am angry with the pharmaceutical companies for hurting my child. And Byron Katie turned that around on her to say, you know, or is it that you are hurting your child? And she made her repeat, I am hurting my child. And it was just,
that's a safe environment for parents with kids with autism. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, Jenny McCarthy came back on eventually, and she just showed a 20-minute video.
That's phoning it in, just showing a video of yourself talking.
Yeah.
She was keynote speaker. Her picture is like on the front of the program and everything.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the Byron Katie thing is representative of the whole Autism One phenomenon. It basically is a quack fest. It is a space where every, you know, fraudulent, unscientific woo therapy for autism can be marketed to parents of kids with autism. That's what it's all about. It's about marketing nonsense to parents who have sick children. Well, Jamie, thanks for coming on the SGU and telling us your story. It was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks Jamie,
and good job.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thanks.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three news items, two real and one fake, and I challenge my skeptical colleagues to tell me which one they think is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Ready.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Jay, I think some of the people on the forums have calculated that you are just at chance so far this year.
Hooray! That's good.
Really? That's okay. Chance is better than psychics.
Didn't you actually do
my
worse
anti-establishment vibe for this year just wasn't working. Like, I've been trying to not pick what Bob picks because I want to catch him on the rare win.
Pick independently of whatever everyone else says.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you got to get a couple right in a row. You got to get above chance. All right, let's go. Item number one, scientists demonstrate that specially tinted glasses can reduce migraine headaches by reducing brain hyperactivation in response to certain visual patterns. Item number two, biologists confirm a link between the retrovirus, XMRV, and chronic fatigue syndrome. And item number three, new research finds that biodegradable products may be worse for the environment than non-biodegradable alternatives. So, Jay, you go first. That way no one will influence you tonight.
Okay, the one about scientists demonstrating that tinted glasses could actually reduce the migraine headaches. There's something about that makes sense. I mean, I really, really don't like not having my sunglasses, particularly when I'm driving. There's something about having them on that helps me relax. And if I don't have my glasses on, I'm squinting more. And I believe that one. The second one, biologists confirmed the link between the retrovirus and the chronic fatigue syndrome. I didn't read anything about it. It seems definitely plausible and something I know that they've been looking for. So that's definitely possible there. And finally, the third one, new research finds about the biodegradable products may be worse for the environment than non-biodegradable alternatives. My God, imagine if that's true. What a freaking blow to earth-friendly products. I myself, I don't recycle.
Except some old jokes, but that's about it.
All right, so for the sake of being moderately pithy here, I'm going to say that I don't believe that the biodegradable one is real. That one's the fake.
Okay, Evan.
And I'll take them in random order. Number one, scientists demonstrate that these specially tinted glasses can reduce migraine headaches by reducing the blah blah. Okay, I don't see a reason why you couldn't tint glasses to reduce migraines that are triggered by certain visual patterns that I would imagine have a lot to do with light. Light intensity, light. I think that one is plausible. Number two, this link between a retrovirus and chronic fatigue syndrome. Yeah, chronic fatigue syndrome is something that's been studied a long time. And I guess we still don't really understand it. This would be a big step in understanding chronic fatigue syndrome better if you could blame it on this retrovirus. The last one about biodegradable products being worse for the environment than non-biodegradable alternatives, either unintended consequences or we just don't see the whole picture until after we wind up implementing these things, then we realize, oops, maybe a problem. Therefore, I'm going to say that the retrovirus, the link between the retrovirus and chronic fatigue syndrome, I think that one's going to be the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
The specially tinted glasses and migraines. The thing that gets me is part of what Evan referred to as blah blah, but I think it might be important. Visual patterns. That one, I'm not really buying that. I don't think it's so much the pattern, but the actual just the intensity of the plain old intensity of the light. Maybe you can define light intensity as a pattern, but I don't know about that one. And hyperactivation.
That's what I was assuming it was. Yeah. I hope I'm correct in that assumption.
The chronic fatigue syndrome and then retrovirus, you know, I just don't know. I know so little about this. My vaguest memory of chronic fatigue syndrome in the news in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years is that, yeah, they were finding some stuff that makes researchers believe that it's not total bullshit. There's something there. But shit, I could be way off on that. The third one, biodegradable products being worse off for the environment. I could see that there could be certain products that degrade, that biodegrade, could release something harmful that they didn't really think about. I'm going to go with the tinted glasses and say that's fiction.
Wow. Okay, Rebecca.
Okay, the tinted glasses makes perfect sense to me. I don't know. I thought that migraine sufferers had been using especially tinted glasses for a long time to ease their migraines. The link between XMRV and chronic fatigue syndrome, I feel like I've heard something about that before, but I don't think that that's ever been conclusively proven or confirmed. I think that chronic fatigue syndrome is an elusive disorder that has yet to be fully explained. That leaves us with biodegradable products, worse for the environment than non. Yeah, I can see that happening. You know, maybe it's in, like Bob said, the way it biodegrades, it leaves something behind, or maybe it's in the manufacture of it. So, yeah, I'm going to go with the XMRV as being the fiction.
All right.
Okay, so we have a nice distribution. Everyone picks something. So I'll take these in order. Number one, scientists demonstrate that specially tinted glasses can reduce migraine headaches by reducing brain hyperactivation in response to certain visual patterns. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Woohoo.
Sorry, Bob. Mm. You've had a good streak. And yeah, Rebecca, you're right. The notion that tinted glasses helps migraines is old. This research is showing how it works,
mm-hmm.
which is how I phrase that. What's interesting is, and Bob, you hit upon one of the details here. It's certain visual patterns. It's not just intensity, and that's part of what they figured out. To back up a little bit, you guys have seen optical illusions in which lines can be there are motion illusions, right? Where when you look at certain colors or lines or in some configuration, it could seem to rotate or wave or move in some way. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an active visual processing, artifact, and those patterns that provoke that kind of visual processing are actually, they're causing activity in the visual cortex, right? And in fact, that activity can provoke a seizure in some patients with epilepsy. And migraines are very similar to seizures in that they can be triggered by this hyperactivation, or patients with seizures and migraines both can get hyperactivation in response to these kinds of stimuli that normally would just produce some activation in a non-epileptic or non-migraineur. For those kinds of visual illusions where, the particular pattern or combination of colors produces, this sense of movement, you can block that effect by filtering out certain colors, certain frequencies of light. That exact color that works best for each individual patient is a little different. So what researchers have done is use fMRI scanning to look at the activation of the visual cortex in response to certain patterns of lines and whatnot. And then they test people, both normal controls and migraineurs, with different tinted glasses. And they found that typically any tinted glass, I guess just simply because you're filtering out some of the light, would reduce this hyperactivation by about 40%. But one specific color, the one that's allegedly fine-tuned to that person, would reduce it by about 70%.
Hmm.
And they're thinking this could be, you could study migraine patients, find out what color works best for them, and then those tinted glasses would eliminate.
It's probably got something to do with their aura.
Yeah, right. Would eliminate. You just got to pick the tint that's your aura color. That's right. Mm-hmm. This would eliminate this one trigger for their migraines. It's not going to cure them of migraines, but you know, it might eliminate this one important trigger. You know, for some people, this is a significant trigger. Thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let's go on to number two. Biologists confirm a link between the retrovirus XMRV and chronic fatigue syndrome. Rebecca and Evan, you think this one is the fake. Jay and Bob think this one is science. And this one is fiction.
Aha. Mm.
Fiction.
Foiled again.
Foiled again, Tarjay. Yes.
A lie.
Now, prior research did show a possible link between XMRV and chronic fatigue syndrome. Again, regardless of what you think chronic fatigue syndrome is, it is a clinical syndrome. If you have, you know, certain symptoms for a certain amount of time, you have the syndrome. But in any case, this a prior study found that as much as 67% of patients with chronic fatigue syndrome had XMRV in their blood. XMRV, by the way, stands for xenotropic murine leukemia virus, which is a retrovirus. However, subsequent replications failed to find an association. They failed to find the XMRV, which called it into serious doubt. Well, a recent study essentially is the final nail in the coffin of XMRV and chronic fatigue syndrome. What researchers have discovered is that the XMRV virus is actually a combination of two different viruses. You know how viruses can mix their genetic material together, and you get like a hybrid virus. They say that the virus arose because of genetic recombination of two mouse viruses, and that it's the mouse source that subsequently infected experiments with XMRV, and therefore previously reported associations. And it's not just with CFS, it's also with prostate cancer. So those were the two things that were being blamed on this virus, that it was all just contamination from mice.
So when can I get rid of my chronic fatigue syndrome?
When you start sleeping.
Okay.
Well, I mean, chronic fatigue syndrome is, you know, fatigue is a maximally nonspecific symptom, right? It's almost any chronic illness can cause fatigue. Just mood can cause fatigue. Lack of sleep, you know, obviously can cause fatigue.
Oh, yeah. I didn't mean to suggest that people who actually have chronic fatigue syndrome just need to get sleep. So I apologize.
No, so there,
in the audience
there
thought
are
I meant that.
Definitely people who have chronic fatigue, whether or not they have their a chronic fatigue syndrome as a unique entity is debatable. That's the thing that's controversial. Some people think, no, if you look hard enough, you'll find an underlying cause. There may also be a real separate chronic fatigue syndrome, and a chronic viral infection has been a primary candidate for a long time. Which means new research finds that biodegradable products may be worse for the environment than non-biodegradable alternatives is science. And you guys, you know, hit upon the notion, yeah, the unintended consequences, not uncommon. Can you guys figure out what it is about biodegradable products that's the problem?
Don't they let off gas or something?
Yeah, they let off methane.
Greenhouse gas.
Yeah, which is actually a very powerful greenhouse gas, much more powerful than CO2. Only about a third, about 35% of landfills capture that methane. About another third, about 34%, will burn the methane off, but a third, about 31%, allow the methane to escape into the atmosphere. But here's the thing about biodegradable products is that in order to meet the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, guideline before you are allowed to call a product biodegradable, it has to decompose quickly. They're actually a little bit vague on what that means, you know, a reasonably short period of time. That's the definition. Obviously, anything will eventually decompose or degrade. So biodegradable means it breaks down. It decomposes very quickly. But that is a problem because a lot of landfills that do put into place some mechanism for capturing or dealing with the methane will wait until the area of the landfill is filled, right? So they'll use a certain area for a couple of years, and then they'll cap it and capture the methane. So if you have a product that breaks down over years, then most of that methane will be captured because most of the methane won't be released until the capturing mechanisms are put into place. But if you have a biodegradable item that's going to break down quickly within a year or two, all of the methane will be released before anything is done to capture it. So the rapidly breaking down actually is a disadvantage given the current setup that we have.
So therefore...
So that's it. So Rebecca and Evan. Rebecca and Evan did a good job this week.
Yeah, awesome. Good job, guys.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Well done, Rebecca.
I like getting a good
job, Evan.
Good even spread. Good job. The non-novellas on the panel won this week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can't claim any kind of favoritism towards the family.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
You guys know who Margaret Fuller is?
No.
Sounds familiar.
She was an American journalist, a critic, and a woman's rights advocate.
Cool.
And she was alive from 1810 to 1850.
Oh.
Just 40 years, huh?
And she had a very interesting quote. "It is astonishing what force, purity, and wisdom it requires for a human being to keep clear of falsehoods." Margaret Fuller!
It is a full-time job keeping falsehoods out of your head.
Mm-hmm. I have an announcement.
Let's hear it.
Anybody who's coming to Skepticon, a.k.a. Convergence, in Minneapolis, June 30th to July 3rd, should know that Skeptic is sponsoring a grassroots activism workshop that's happening the first day of Skepticon. So that is going to be on Thursday, June 30th. And there'll be a link in the notes. And it's free, but you can give us a donation if you want. Learn how to grow skepticism as a movement.
A couple other quick things. The DVD set of the lectures from TAM Australia is now available. TAM Oz DVD. If you get the pre-order from the Australian Skeptics website, you get a 10% discount. So go to skeptics.com.au/shop to get hours of skepticism. 24, I believe, is...
That's a day of skepticism.
Day of lectures. That's true. And a slight change to the upcoming TAM 9 schedule. The SGU dinner was scheduled to be on Saturday, July 16th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., but had to be moved due to scheduling conflicts. It will now be from 6 to 8 p.m. on Friday night. We typically do the dinner on Friday night. We moved it to Saturday night this year to avoid other stuff, but now we're moving it back to Friday because that's when the room's available at the hotel. If anyone who has already purchased a ticket for the SGU dinner, if that changes your plans and you can't make it or anything like that, then contact the JREF and they'll give you a refund. They'll work it out with you. They'll do whatever. So, you know, obviously sorry to make the change at this late a time, but they'll take care of it. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, guys.
Hey, it was fun.
Good night.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website. Or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.